This is a CNA podcast.
The coronavirus pandemic may have ravaged entire economies and put many sectors out of work. But there's one business that's booming: cybercrime. You might have come across it yourself. A dubious text saying your parcel has been stuck at the post office and needs some form of payment before it can be released. Or a WhatsApp message asking for your banking OTP to update your Netflix payment details. Such banking phishing scams have spiked more than 2,500% in the first half of 2020 alone in Singapore. What's behind this surge? Why are some of us still falling prey to these scams? I'm Lin Su Ling, and welcome to Heart of the Matter, where we take a deep dive each week into one of the biggest news stories. Now, my guest this week will tackle these issues and more are Dr. Carol Soon, Senior Research Fellow at the Institute of Policy Studies and Vice Chair of the Media Literacy Council.
Hi, everyone.
And Shashwat Khandelwal, Head of Consumer Business Southeast Asia at McAfee.
Good morning, folks.
Hello. Let's start, before we go into what's behind the surge, who are the people falling for scams? Because we ask our Facebook followers to share their experiences, and some people have said it's the gullible that will fall prey to these things. What are your thoughts? Who are the people?
So it's been our experience that the folks falling for these scams are across all age groups, across both genders. We would like to think that we will not be the gullible ones, but depending on the type of scam, there is a hook that captures a different type of person, and that hook can apply to any of us.
People tend to think that it's the people who are in their 50s, who are not so savvy with digital devices, that are the victims in this. Carol, what is Singapore Media Literacy Council saying when you look at all these stats? Who are the people that we need to reach out to?
So when we talk about digital scams, it's right that we don't really see a particular pattern with regards to a group that's especially more susceptible. We often think and assume seniors might be more susceptible because they are less savvy with technology. But if we focus on digital scams, I think a lot of us are guilty of that. People generally across all ages suffer from optimism bias, and optimism bias can operate at two levels. At one level, we wake up, we don't expect bad things to happen to us. So because of that, we are not really on guard. But more importantly, we always think that, okay, digital scams, phishing is unlikely to happen to me.
Okay, but what's behind this surge then? Because 2,500% is really huge. But it's also in line with global trends, no, Shashwat?
Yeah, it is in line with global trends. We're seeing this across everywhere. And a lot of it has to do with the fact that the criminals cannot conduct crime in the traditional sense because of the pandemic. So a lot of the criminals are also moving towards cybercrime. That's literally just happening across the globe. And a lot of the scams today are around the pandemic.
So it's just a supply issue? Is that what you're getting at?
In some sense, yes.
There's a demand issue as well. So earlier I talked about the personal level, the individual social cognitive factors such as optimism bias. The other thing that we need to think about is the situational factor, right? Because of COVID-19, it has really, well, without sounding cliche, changed the way we lived our lives. So we are seeking entertainment at home. We are conducting our social interactions at home, online. So global reports have shown a huge surge in terms of the amount of time people spend online, whether it's to do shopping or to catch up with friends or to seek entertainment, like download and watch movies on Netflix, etc.
But what's driving people to part with all this money? Because in Singapore, some of the amounts have been quite astronomical, 500,000 in one case alone. Surely when such huge amounts of money are involved, you would think twice before you give out your details to your bank accounts, to those huge sums of money. You would think again, why aren't we doing that?
One of the reasons is, again, if we go back to human psychology, oftentimes we do not want to miss out on a good deal. And it's not because we are being cheap or we want to gain advantage of something, but if it results in savings, why not? And in the COVID-19 pandemic, a lot of people are facing economic precarity. They lose their jobs, they don't have enough money, they are probably subconsciously on the lookout for good bargains, etc. The other thing to consider is the strategy of some of these scammers. They oftentimes tell very good stories and they instill a sense of urgency so that you feel that you have to act now, you have to click on the link or you have to download an attachment.
Absolutely. So that is on the opportunistic side and our desire for not missing out. But on the other hand, the scammers themselves, depending on the nature of the scam, for example, if the scam involves a remote desktop attack where the user is convinced to log in and share the login details, then in that case, once the scammer has access to somebody's bank account, then the amount being stolen is literally as much there is in the bank account. So it's not that we are giving up as much as $500,000 and not realizing it. It's just that we don't have any control at that point in time because the scammer is controlling our account.
Right. You guys have talked a lot about the various vulnerabilities from the human to the software to the backend, I suppose, on your laptop and whatnot. But could you maybe unpack for us a little bit, Shashwat, first on what are the key kinds of scams when it comes to phishing that we're seeing a lot in Singapore? What are the key ones?
Broadly, the kind of scams that we're looking at are banking scams, where somebody is told that they need to give banking access to the scammer. Like you gave the example of some package stuck somewhere and a payment has to be made or some transaction that needs to be cleared. The second kind of scams that we're seeing a lot of are around COVID-19 itself, where people are being told that there are these remedies available at a time earlier on where there was a shortage of masks. They were being offered. We've had instances where people are offering plasma, which from a person who's recovered from COVID-19, and that's typically a scam. Other than these kind of scams, we still have the usual love scams and the social media scams where information is being extracted from people. And one thing that we've seen a rise in is also around people's entertainment. So a lot of gaming machines, you know, your Xboxes and PlayStations are being offered, but you make the payment and you never receive the item that you bought.
I see you're getting at the point that these scammers are playing on people's vulnerabilities and they're playing on people's fears at this time of COVID-19 when people are worried about access to masks, and at the same time also playing on people's curiosity, surfing the internet for distractions and whatnot. Mm-hmm. I see that. But phishing scams have been around for a very long time. Why is it that we're still falling prey to that? Surely we would have picked up that, hey, there's a pattern here.
At the end of the day, there are both a lot more people online, and at the same time, there are a lot more scams that just McAfee has detected such tremendous increase worldwide in the number of scam attempts as well. Both the demand and the supply are on the rise. It takes the person to be scammed just the one time for that statistic to get added.
Carol, is that what you're also seeing? A lot of first-timers being scammed for the first time. That's the reason why even the click rates for phishing emails, I've noticed in some surveys that have been done around the world, have gone up, actually. There was one survey that I saw where the click rate for these global phishing emails and messages have moved from somewhere from 5 to 40%.
If we talk about why, yes, you're right. You know, scams have been around for a long time. I remember before social media, when we were all using, relying so much on emails, there was your Nigerian love scams. Not that they are no longer around, but you see a greater variety of scams. Two important things account for this. Number one, like I mentioned earlier, and this is supported by global reports, people simply are spending more time online, and COVID-19 kind of increased that amount of time many more times. And the other very important thing is the evolution of the scammer strategies. So increasingly, they are getting more sophisticated and more adept at masquerading as authoritative and well-known organizations. So universities included, like mine, NUS. Then you have banks, local trusted brands that people are so familiar with, as well as, for instance, SingPost. This spoofing of real organizations and real websites with a long legacy of trust and credibility definitely is one relatively evolving tactic. The other one, and that kind of gels with how social media sites like Facebook, being a very popular quote-unquote platform for scammers, is the reliance on people's trust in their social networks. Mm. Our trust in our friends and family members.
But the friends are not the ones that are scamming us, though.
No, they're not. But they spoof some of these friends' account. And I'm not sure about you, but I certainly have received quite a few of those where it's an innocuous, hi, Carol, you know, how are you? And then it proceeds to asking for phone numbers, etc. So those of us who are in the so-called business, we may be more on guard. But I can imagine how natural and how easy it is for people to just respond to messages from people whom they think are their friends and family members.
So I suppose what you're saying also is that it's the platform, because if it's on our social media, we'll tend to let our guard down when it's our WhatsApp message, even these mediums that we're so used to, informal communications with a trusted loop of people. That's also the reason why the scams are going up.
Yes, so this sense of familiarity, this subconscious trust in, okay, generally what I receive from my friends and family members, especially the close ones, are likely to be safe, reliable, and trustworthy. And that's not limited to digital scams such as phishing. In a recently completed study I did on disinformation, false information, we see that too, how people will actually rely and tend to believe in the kind of information that's shared by their close friends and family members.
So there are many things at play here. It's not just the person who we think it's coming from, the organisation, it's also the platform. But then, as you mentioned also, it's also about scammers being able to hack into your private information on your laptop and whatnot. Shaswat, can you try to bring us through what are the various sophisticated strategies that have been employed in this field that you've seen in the recent 6 months, I guess?
There are so many instances where the attack vector comes from a trusted source, because now scammers are getting to the point where a person, let's say you're in finance, you could receive an email from what looks like your CEO asking for an urgent payment to be made to this entity. And you look at that email, you may not even realize that this is a spoofed email. Or perhaps it could be worse and your CEO's email address may actually have been hacked, in which case the email has legitimately come from your CEO's account, but it is directing you to make a payment to an unknown entity. That is a very difficult attack vector to counter. Similarly, in a social media setting, if your friend's account is hacked, you wouldn't know. Like Carol mentioned, your trust has already been established there. So you're that much more vulnerable to an attack that is coming from there. Thirdly, compared to the Nigerian love scams of the past, right, they would actually back then deliberately have mistakes in their email because they wanted people who were more careful to get out of the queue quicker. It was inefficient to bring on somebody who would eventually not get scammed.
So it was
scammed.
A strategy to filter people out.
It was deliberate to have those errors in there. But increasingly, the sites are getting so sophisticated, the scammer sites, that you would not be able to look and tell it apart from the original one. Just our own requirement to be cautious and to be careful and to look for those, like HTTPS, because S there stands for secure, those parameters start to matter a lot more.
So, Carol, when you hear about how sophisticated these tactics are getting, the challenge is that public education calls to up our awareness of these tactics have been quite widespread. But then, do you still have faith in that strategy, given that the tactics are evolving constantly and rapidly?
I think that's the reality of the internet era that we live in. Whether it's disinformation campaigns, scams, even in positive things like the use of internet to organize ground-up community actions, because human beings are inherently smart and always evolving, things would always improve and change. And the fact that technology is also becoming cheaper and easier to use kind of catalyze progression in strategies. That said, I don't think we should ever let up on public education. Obviously, in the case of digital scams, we see organizations such as the Singapore Police Force, Media Literacy Council, as well as the Cybersecurity Agency doing their bits to reach out to different segments of the population. Now, just because we see this increasing rates in people falling prey does not necessarily mean that these education efforts are not working. Until we do a proper assessment, as a researcher, I believe in that, we cannot say exactly what works, what doesn't work, and why. So yes, public education will have to continue. In fact, it will have to evolve as quickly as the scammers' tactics.
So that's the thing, because public education usually takes a form of this is what to look out for when you encounter a scam. You'll see the emails a little bit off, the language is a little bit off. But what Shaswat is also saying is that if they can hack into the authoritative person's email address, then how is that going to work? Because those steps won't be useful anymore.
Mm. So here we're talking about features of the scam, right? Yes, they may change, but I think certain habits would apply regardless of the features of the scams. So for example, one of which is this putting yourself on a constant vigilant mode. This is true. If something is too good, it is unlikely to be true. So to be more conscious of that, that's number one. The other way of being vigilant is to practice digital hygiene. In other words, whenever you see links or attachments, our default attitude should be do not click, especially if it's the email or the text message is an unsolicited one. So these are the things that we can kind of cultivate a habit to do.
I want to throw this over to Shaswat, because I think the question that I have therefore is a lot of these tips and things to look out for are quite backward looking. They're based on past incidences. But if you're saying that these tactics are evolving so fast that we are struggling to keep up, what then is a forward looking strategy to warn people of these things?
So one approach purely for the kind of confidence scams is to put in place processes that can counter it. For the example of responding to the CEO's email to make a payment, if there are processes in place where that needs to be vetted before that action is taken, that will essentially take care of it. Maybe verify back with the person who's making the request on a different channel from the one that you originally received the request on. The fact of the matter is that at the back of our minds, we know that there is something odd about it.
I'm going to press you on this point because you're arguing for human intervention. But at McAfee, is there a technology that can solve this?
Because absolutely.
I have in mind, you know, we have physical mailboxes and there's so much junk mail that comes in. And, you know, all you can do is to push that lever and then no more junk mail can come in. Is there a similar technology analogy?
There is. When it comes to the social engineering aspect of it, there is only so far a technology can go. But what the technology will help you with is if you are using an appropriate security software on your devices, it will prevent you from visiting links that are unsafe. So if
for example, like a pop-up, a warning.
Yes. So those pop-ups you're protected against. We will also protect a user. Let's say, for example, if a scammer is telling a user to go visit a website that allows remote desktop access. So we will throw a pop-up in front of the user to say that, hey, be mindful. This is where you stop and think about what is being asked of you. So those are the kind of things that technology can absolutely do. But it always has to go hand in hand with us maintaining our vigilance and being cautious. Like, if, for example, if you've received a great promotion, something that sounds too good to be true, instead of clicking on it, search it independently, go to that actual website and validate for yourself if that deal is really there.
Let me pick up on that point, which I think is really important. And this also kind of links to your question, Su Lin, about the action that we take. Does it always have to be retrospective? The other thing we want to tell people and we want to make available to them is the information repository. Sources where they can actually go to when they're in doubt. Right? We're telling people you need to be vigilant. You need to be more suspicious. But we also need to give them a means to fact check, to verify.
But right? Carol, arguably these people who fall prey to scams are people who click too fast, that split moment. These aren't people who would naturally go and find out and be more doubtful though.
Yes, but sometimes we also need to give them the information so that there are people who may not click immediately, okay? And these are the people who possibly are sitting on the fence, right? They're on the fringe. They can tilt either way. So we want to make this information available to people. The other important thing, why information will be important, is we want to also encourage people to play a more active role in inoculating others in their social networks. So say I have family members and friends in my WhatsApp chat, and I know that this is being circulated, and I want to warn these people in advance. It may not be enough for me to just tell them, hey, this is not true, be careful, don't click on this when you see it. People need evidence. Most of us want some kind of data. So if we can share with them some existing information from trusted sources, they are more likely to heed our advice
and level up altogether. But this call for vigilance, though, I'm quite concerned because on the one hand, people say we have to have that sort of alertness all the time before we click because we don't know what will be a phishing email, what's legitimate. But the challenge is, do you think that these fears are turning people away from digital communications altogether? Because a CSA survey, the Cybersecurity Agency of Singapore, had a survey in 2019 showing that, yes, people are not very good with identifying what were phishing emails. But on the other hand, more than half also thought the legitimate emails were phishing emails. So how do you prevent that and strike that balance?
In that, Su Lin, it's a process. Because there will never be a point in time where we would be 100% confident that we've done everything we can to prevent people from falling victim to scams. And in that process, it's about being able to educate more and more people. My own gut feel about this is that there is a sizable population that is cautious. There's a population that is on the fence. And there are some who are careless, but for the first time. After you've had an experience personally, I would like to think that people will wisen up and they will then be more cautious with similar scams.
So basically being very targeted and trying to target these campaigns towards a certain segment. What's your view, Carol? Because on the one hand, we do want to encourage people to be more digitally savvy, right? And that's part of the messages from the Media Literacy Council. But how do you balance that against creating a culture of paranoia?
Well, if we look at the kind of information people are putting out there, other than certain anecdotes we're not observing any signs of a population that's becoming paranoid. Our current challenge right now is people who are not savvy enough, not careful enough, and do not practice what we call click restraint. Mm. The point why social media is so widely used and it's so popular among all of us is because they make and encourage frictionless kind of engagement, right? Which is why it makes sharing information so easy and so powerful. Because of that, it's the nature of technology that kind of overwhelms, which means that some personal habits need to be better cultivated to kind of balance the affordances that technology gives us.
So we talked a lot about personal responsibility, and definitely that cannot be eschewed. Yet, when it comes to these scams, a lot of it, as you mentioned, is impersonation of known trusted organizations. They have their reputations on the line. These are banks, telcos, organizations that we do business with. Should the main responsibility for these not lie with them in countering impersonation almost?
Organizations do take action against scammers in scenarios like this. But the challenge becomes that with the way our internet today is, the scammer may not be residing in Singapore. There's really not much that you can do from that jurisdiction. There is, of course, international engagements to bring such people to justice, but it makes it a game of whack-a-mole because you take one down and there's another one that pops up. So yes, they're doing their part, and the law enforcement and government agencies are doing theirs as well. But at the same time, we still have to maintain our caution.
So there's definitely a level of protection already that most organizations have, and even workplaces. And you mentioned, Carol, NUS itself, it suffered an attack last year when there was a phishing attack asking for students and alumni to click on a certain link. Apart from, you know, sending out emails to tell people in the organization, please be careful, this is happening, what more do you think could have been done? Maybe not in that case, but generally speaking, when it comes to workplaces.
Some institutions are trying to educate their employees as well. So definitely that's one. And probably you're in a better position to comment on some of the security measures that organizations are adopting to do this. But back to your earlier point about what more should organizations do. Yes, even in the recent case where there were fake emails sent from a fake Ministry of Manpower address telling people to click on a particular link so that they can find out more about the COVID-19 support fund. Obviously, when these things happen, institutions would step up and clarify and debunk the falsehoods. But these often happen after the fact. A lot of these scams are now being spread in what we call closed communication platforms, like instant messaging. And until someone makes a complaint or reports to the police, the institution is actually in the dark, right? So yes, they can take proactive measures. They obviously are taking reactive measures. But unfortunately, at the end of the day, the biggest responsibility does lie with individuals.
So I'm going to end off with a couple of questions left. The first one actually is, have you guys ever fallen prey to a phishing scam, or at least have you encountered one? Did you have a close shave and you could tell our listeners about that?
My instance was when I received a call about my internet slowing down. And
a phone call?
A phone call telling me that my internet was slowing down and that the person was calling from my telco and that I should go through the following steps so as to remediate that. As soon as I received the call, I knew it was a scam call.
What told you it was a scam call?
Partly it's because of the background and the experience, but also because of the kind of questions that they were asking. It's a scam that if you're in the space, you know that this is a scam that's doing the rounds, so to speak. So I listened in genuinely out of curiosity. I wanted to see how the scam plays out. So I kind of carried on listening and taking the advice up to the point where they had me log into a remote desktop site, and then I told them, no, I don't feel like getting scammed.
So you were
today.
Taking notes all the way.
I was taking notes all the way. I mean, it was a research project at that point.
That's very interesting. Carol?
Nothing too major. I think Instagram, I'm not sure about you guys, I use it for a variety of reasons, including work. On a daily basis, there are just so many friend requests from unknown people, and usually accounts that are supposedly male accounts, and those are quite obvious, you know, so you just delete the friend accounts because you really do not want to befriend strangers in this age, cultivate some kind of a strange relationship and become vulnerable. But I had someone who is known to me, instant messaging me, asking me how I am, asking me for my phone number, maybe because it's the nature of my work, so naturally I was on guard. So what I did was to message this friend on my WhatsApp to let the person know. And this is not uncommon, right? But we should not ignore. So we should at least take whatever action we can. So in this case, in this very simple case, the action I took was to inform this friend so that at least he could inform the people in the social network. So hopefully no one gets duped. My dad received a call from a supposed MOH tracer. But because he missed the call, the person left a number behind. So when my dad tried calling back and there was no pickup, he got a bit concerned and he called me, and I was glad he called me. I told him, if it's legit, don't worry. The government will somehow get in touch with you. You don't have to worry about the police. You don't have to worry about MOH. But we knew that that was a kind of a scam calls. So we just need to play our part and be there for our friends and family members as well.
Definitely not a good day for these scammers who encountered you both. Very unfortunate for them. No business there. Did you have parting shots that you want to leave our listeners with, thinking about the incidents of phishing emails and online scams that have been on the rise this COVID-19 season, and possibly more when more people stay at home and go online?
One thing we talk about within McAfee is that cybersecurity is a team sport. We have to help each other out. We have to work with one another. And it's not just technology that will solve all of our problems, not just the social aspects. All of it together will.
I don't want people to think that it's a lost cause because scammers are becoming smarter and more sophisticated. There is basic hygienic practices that we can adopt and we can practice regularly. And if we do so, we can protect ourselves and our loved ones.
Well, there you have it. Phishing season is now 365 days a year with this raging coronavirus accelerating our use of digital devices. But as you've heard from these experts, while more can be done to up our savviness and efforts to stem these scams, it's an optimistic picture. That was Dr. Carol Soon, Senior Research Fellow and Head of Society and Culture at the Institute of Policy Studies, who's also Vice Chair from the Singapore Media Literacy Council, and Shashwat Kandawa, Head of Consumer Business Southeast Asia at McAfee. You've been listening to Heart of the Matter with Crispina Robert, our podcast editor, and Erin Lo, our research writer, working hard behind the scenes. And I'm Lin Su Ling, signing off.